I'm just curious, who was not here last week? Okay, so we got a few. We spent most of the time, well, actually all of the time last week. We covered one verse of Daniel. We spent most of our time talking about the theological and historical backdrop for the book. So I want to just do a bit of a review there, but rather than having me talk about the review, I want to read an account out of 2 Chronicles that should remind you of some of the high points of what we talked about last week. And then we'll move as far as we can go through Daniel chapter 1 today. So I'm going to begin reading in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, beginning with verse 20. After all this, this refers to the reforms of Josiah, who was the king of the southern kingdom of Judah. After all of his reforms, when Josiah had set the temple in order, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to make war at Carchemish on the Euphrates, and Josiah went out to engage him. But Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What have we to do with one another, O king of Judah? I'm not coming out against you today, but against the house at which I am at war." That would be the Chaldean Empire. "And God has ordered me to hurry. Stop for your own sake from interfering with God who is with me, that he may not destroy you." However, Josiah would not turn away from him, but disguised himself in order to make war with him. Nor did he listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God, but came to make war in the plain of Megiddo. The Egyptian archers shot King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, "Take me away, for I'm badly wounded." So his servants took him out of the chariot, and they carried him in a second chariot, which he had brought with him to Jerusalem, where he died, and he was buried in the tombs of his fathers. All Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. Then Jeremiah chanted a lament for Josiah, and all the male and female singers speak about Josiah and their lamentations to this day. And they made them an ordinance in Israel. Behold, they're also written in the Lamentations. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah and his deeds of devotion as written in the law of the Lord and his acts, first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and of Judah. Then the people of the land took Jehoahaz. Now you may recall I pronounced that Jehoahaz last week, but it's written both ways. It depends on whether you're reading in Chronicles or you're reading in 2 Kings. Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king in place of his father in Jerusalem. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. Then the king of Egypt deposed him at Jerusalem and imposed on the land a fine of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. The king of Egypt made Eliakim, his brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. But Necho took Jehoahaz, his brother, and he brought him to Egypt. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Remember, his father was Manasseh, who was the worst king of the southern kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against him and bound him with bronze chains to take him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also brought some of the articles of the house of the Lord to Babylon, and he put them in his temple in Babylon. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and the abominations which he did and that what was found against him, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. And Jehoiachin, his son, became king in his place. Jehoiachin was 8. Now there's a textual issue here. My translation says 8 years old. Some of yours will read 18 years old. Depends on which manuscript the translators used. I'm suspicious that it's probably 18. He became king, and he reigned 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. At the turn of the year, when Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the valuable articles of the house of the Lord, and he made his kinsman Zedekiah king over Judah and Jerusalem. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord his God, and he did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet who spoke for the Lord. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear allegiance by God. But he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. Furthermore, all the officials of the priests and the people were very unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they defiled the house of the Lord, which he had sanctified in Jerusalem. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent word to them again and again by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they continually mocked the messengers of God, despised their words, and scoffed his prophets until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people until there was no remedy. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hands. All the articles of the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king and of his officers, he brought them all to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all of its fortified buildings with fire, and destroyed all of its valuable articles. Those who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the king of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. These events and many other events that we discussed last week are recorded here in 2 Chronicles, and they're summarized in the opening verse of Daniel 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he besieged it. If I were to reference 2 points from last week's lesson, one of those points would be historical and the other would be theological. The important theological point has to do with something we spent quite a bit of time on, the 5 cycles of divine discipline that we see in Leviticus chapter 26. God is a God of mercy. As a God of mercy, he desires repentance for his people when they sin, and he certainly does the same for nations. Now, our interest here in the book of Daniel is the nation of Israel. So when God brings discipline on a nation, and in particular the nation of Israel, what he wants from that discipline is for the nation to turn to him in repentance and be reconciled. Of the 5 cycles of discipline that we discussed last week, 2 are particularly pertinent, the 4th and 5th cycles. In the 4th cycle, the unrepentant nation becomes a second-rate nation. It is typically under hegemonic rule of a foreign power, and it's buried under economic hardship. When that nation, if it does, moves into the 5th cycle of discipline, the nation is destroyed. The northern kingdom went under 5th cycle discipline in 722 BC when the Assyrians defeated the Israelites and exiled the population, which effectively put an end to the 10 tribes that made up the northern kingdom. The Assyrians set up an imperial administrative presence in Samaria, so they are effectively just across the street from Judea, and they became an imminent threat to the southern kingdom because of their military strength and the proximity to Judah. In 722 BC, when the northern kingdom was destroyed, Judah entered 4th cycle discipline. In other words, they still functioned as a nation, but they were not able to defend themselves. Their economy was destroyed, and they were effectively under the rule of a foreign power. The important historical points pertain to the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Chaldeans. If you go back to and think about the power the powerful nations of the 8th century BC, the Assyrian Empire was the strongest nation in the world. Babylonia, which we think of as a powerful nation, was at that time a vassal state of the Assyrians. So if you want to think about it in terms of Leviticus 26, when the Assyrians are exercising control over Babylon, Babylon is effectively in 4th cycle. They are under the hegemonic control of the Assyrian Empire. In 625 BC, an unknown leader of a group of about 5 tribes that came to be known as the Chaldeans rose up. His name was Nabopolassar. And he came down and he didn't attack the Assyrian Empire at first. He came and he attacked the Babylonians. He attacked a vassal state of the Assyrians, which of course perturbed them because this is tax revenue that they're going to lose. And we have this foreign power that's beginning to meddle in the political and military affairs of the Assyrians. So Assyria marches south to support their vassal state, Babylonia, against this invading Chaldean force. And around 625 BC, war began to break out between the Assyrians and the Chaldeans. This went on for several years, and in 612 BC, Nabopolassar defeated the Assyrians and overran Nineveh, which was their capital. What was left of the Assyrian army then ran up to Haran, which is a little bit north and a little bit west. And there was another battle there in 610 BC, which caused the Assyrians to retreat further to Carchemish, northwest of Haran. And that sets up a battle that occurred later on. So what we have at Carchemish is we have the Assyrians who are more or less devastated. They've retreated to that point, and that brings us to the story that we read in 2 Chronicles, which outlines the Battle of Carchemish. And you see, what had happened is as the Assyrian Empire began to lose power, Egypt saw an opportunity. So they came in and more or less took control of Israel. So Israel, under fourth cycle discipline, is under the hegemonic rule of a foreign power. That changes from the Assyrians to the Egyptians. So Pharaoh Necho is very influential in the affairs of Israel at this point in Israel's history. So he marches north. He comes up the south rim of the Mediterranean Sea through Gaza. He goes through Ashdod and Ashkelon. He comes inward into what would be Samaria. He goes north, and he is met at Megiddo by Josiah and the army of the Judeans. And as we read, Necho says, look, I don't have a problem with you. I'm going to Carchemish to fight someone else. Leave me alone. Don't slow me down. Josiah doesn't listen. He goes and engages Necho at Megiddo, and he's killed. What the intent was on the part of Pharaoh Necho was to co-opt what was left of the Assyrian army to fight against Nabopolassar and the Chaldean Empire. So Pharaoh Necho goes. He does engage the Chaldeans at Carchemish, and he's defeated handily by the Chaldeans under Nabopolassar and under a particular general who was leading the army. This marked a power shift in the ancient Near East that set the stage for the invasions of Jerusalem and the southern kingdom of Judah by the Chaldeans. It was Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar II, who defeated Pharaoh Necho at Carchemish and who led the subsequent then invasions of Jerusalem. If all these historical events had not come into place like they did, then the attack on Jerusalem would have been far more difficult to do. There actually were three invasions. There was an invasion in 605 BC. There was another invasion in 598 BC, and a third and most devastating invasion in 586 BC. And it was during this third invasion in 586 that Jerusalem was destroyed, and the majority of the exile occurred. Now, Daniel mentions the first exile in his book. He doesn't mention the second invasion or the third invasion because he's not in Israel when this takes place. He's already in Babylon. Now, it should be quite obvious that when the third invasion occurred in 586, Judah, like their northern brethren, went under fifth cycle discipline, as Israel, the northern kingdom, had done in 722 BC. So this is a real quick summary of what turned out to be an hour and 10 minutes last week. So let's turn to the exegesis of the book, and we'll look at the first two verses to begin. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. With the defeat of the Egyptians at the Battle of Carchemish, Pharaoh Necho heads back to Egypt, defeated. And his trip back takes him through the middle of Israel. So Nebuchadnezzar's in hot pursuit of Pharaoh Necho, and he comes to Jerusalem. And he sees this city on the hill. It's a beautiful hill. And he lets Necho go. Necho continues on back to Egypt, and Nebuchadnezzar stops, and he surrounds the city, and he demands the surrender of Jerusalem. So Egypt had taken advantage of the weakened power of Assyria and had gained some influence in Israel until the Chaldeans destroyed Nineveh, and at that point the Egyptians then were on the run. A characteristic of stage four discipline is that the nation is under the control of a foreign power, and the Chaldeans are about to take that role from Egypt. The destiny of Judah was actually set at the end of the reign of Manasseh, Josiah's father. Josiah was a great king. He brought into place some extremely good and righteous reforms, but he never could purge the evil that Manasseh, his father, had brought on the nation. So, though he tried at Megiddo, Josiah ends up getting killed. When Nabopolassar took Nineveh in 612, the fate of Judah was absolutely set, and it was sealed with the defeat of Egypt and Assyria at Carchemish. It's now only going to be a matter of time before the new power of the ancient Near East, the Chaldean Empire, takes Jerusalem, and that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar is about to do. There's a theological point in verse 2 that we don't want to miss. Verse 2 says, "The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand," that is, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. We can read the history, we can study the battles, and we can see how the armies align themselves. But we miss the point if we don't look beyond the politics and the battles and understand that what happened to Judah was a deliberate act on the part of Israel's God. When Daniel speaks of the exile, he doesn't talk about Manasseh and the evil that he did. He doesn't speak of Israel's sin and Israel's refusal to repent. These are not given as reasons for the exile. All that's said is the Lord gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this may seem like a vague and weak explanation. I suspect it caused a great deal of reflection on the part of the Jews who had lost their country, who were now finding themselves in exile. But what we have to remember is that external appearances are not prerequisites for God's sovereign acts. Appearances are not always what they seem. In one sense, the Jews must have wanted a more tangible explanation. But on another level, when we think about it theologically, even in Babylon, the Jews were not outside the sphere of God's sovereign control. To be in the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, or in a lion's den, or in a fiery furnace, is not to be out of control, not to be out of the control of God. And that's the point of those stories. The story is a story of God acting in history. And God's actions in history don't come to an end with the exile. If you think about it, even some of the vessels that were brought back to Babylon that are now in the temple of Marduk are a silent hint that God is still at work. The doctrine of God's sovereignty made the faith context for Daniel and his friends as they faced life away from the covenant land that God had given them. But, you know, they could even look at their own history. These exiles in Babylon could look back to the time when their ancestors were slaves in Egypt. And God had made a promise to Abraham. And when his descendants went to Egypt and were in the mud pits making bricks for the Egyptians, that promise went to Egypt with the Jews. God never abandoned them. God put them in a difficult situation, but the promise went with them. And when Daniel and the Jews are taken into exile in Babylon, the covenant goes with them, even though they're not in the covenant land. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's surrounding Jerusalem. He's doing all this that we read about in the first invasion when Nabopolassar, his father, dies. His father died very soon after the Battle of Carchemish. It made it imperative that Nebuchadnezzar leave Jerusalem and go back to his home for his own coronation as king. It's interesting that in verse 1 we read of Nebuchadnezzar and he's called the king of Babylon. When I was at the University of Michigan, of course, there weren't a lot of DTS grads there or conservatives, I assure you. Their position on the book of Daniel was that Daniel didn't write the book. The book was not written in the 6th century, but in 165 BC. And the historical accuracy of the text is flawed. And one of the things they would point to is this reference to Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Babylon. Because he really wasn't the king of Babylon at this point. He was the general who reported to his father, who was the king of Babylon. So I began to think about this. Well, technically they're right. He's not the king of Babylon at this point. But in my thinking, this is not indicative of error. It is normal usage of language. Think about a biographer writing about American presidents. I can envision a sentence in a biography that reads, "President Kennedy was born in May 1917 in Brookline, Massachusetts." Would that bother you if you read that? Would you think, well, this biography is a forgery? Kennedy wasn't president in 1917 when he was born. And yet the perspective of a biographer writing after his inauguration in 1961 might readily refer to him as President Kennedy. And only someone looking for a reason to doubt the text would doubt that statement. This is nothing more than that. Daniel wrote these words around 537 BC, approximately 70 years after the coronation of Nebuchadnezzar. So when he thought of Nebuchadnezzar and when he spoke of Nebuchadnezzar, he spoke of him as the king of Babylon. Now, verse 2 says that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels, and he brought all of these to the land of Shinar. It's an ancient term. It refers to the southeastern part of modern Iraq. It's a word that we see in Genesis 10 and Genesis 11. I think there's an occasion in Joshua chapter 7 where that part of the world is referred to. It's simply the area around Babylon. So Shinar is a place, but it's more than a place. It's a place that stands for false religion. It stands for self-will. It stands for pride. It stands for disobedience to God. It's the empire of Nimrod, the rebel, in Genesis 10. And it was the location of the Tower of Babel, where men, first as a united opposition to God, organized themselves. And God had to divide the language to keep the people from destroying themselves. Israel's idolatry has brought her to idolatry central. Let's look at verses 3 through 7. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring some of the sons, including some of the royal family of the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had the ability serving in the king's court, and he ordered them to teach these boys the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. And he appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Jehoiakim was the king of Judah at the time of this first invasion. Nebuchadnezzar admired Jehoiakim's faithfulness to King Necho, so he left him on the throne, and he made him a puppet king of the Chaldean Empire. To ensure his continued loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, he ordered his chief of staff to bring some of the sons of Israel, particularly those of the royal family, to Babylon. Since Nebuchadnezzar had to run back to Babylon very quickly because of the death of his father, it's likely that the number of exiles who were brought back in this first deportation were maybe no more than 50 to 70. That seems to be a consensus among a lot of the commentators. This is not a mass exile that's happening at this point. But the ones who were chosen were significant choices. They were members of the royal family, maybe the family of David. They were the member of other noble families. And Daniel and his friends were taken. And because he was chosen, he must have been someone that was held in high regard, perhaps being even of royal blood. We don't know that for sure, but that's possible. Even though the numbers were small, the boys who were chosen could be used as leverage against Jehoiakim if perchance in the future he decided to revolt against Nebuchadnezzar. But beyond using these boys as bargaining chips with the Judean king, the more immediate purpose was to train them to serve in the Chaldean government, specifically to serve as personal aides to the king himself. If you read Plato, you know that the Persians began educating hostages, political hostages, at around the age of 14. It's very likely that the Persians adopted this process from the Chaldeans, whose empire they overran. And if this is true, Daniel was probably around 14 years old, as were the other boys when he was taken to Babylon. Xenophon, a Greek historian, tells us that this education process took approximately 3 years, and that fits exactly with the time frame that we see in Daniel chapter 1, verse 5. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that the invasion of Jerusalem and the deportation of these young men was not a random accident of history. It was a deliberate act on the part of Israel's own God. In fact, it was a fulfillment of a prophecy that Isaiah made about over 100 years earlier. If you look, or just listen, you don't have to look. Isaiah chapter 39, beginning with verse 5 through verse 7, Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and your fathers have laid up in store to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord." Now, that was, first of all, kind of interesting, because at that point, Babylon is not a big power. They're not the ones who are likely to overrun Jerusalem. It would have been the Assyrians. But Isaiah says, no, it's going to be Babylon. Verse 7, "And some of your sons who shall issue from you, whom you shall beget, shall be taken away, and they shall become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon." Hezekiah was the king of Judah from 739 to 687 B.C. And this prophecy was a stark declaration of what's coming. In fact, there may be something else that occurs in Daniel 1 that we can explain from the records that we have about Hezekiah, namely the theft of the temple vessels. The thing that led Isaiah to make this prophecy about the people being carried off to Babylon, which he made to Hezekiah, is the fact that if you look at the beginning of that chapter in Isaiah 39, Isaiah refers to a time when a Babylonian dignitary came for an official visit to the Judean king, and the king, Hezekiah, takes him back to the royal treasury. And he shows a man named Merodach-Baladan all of the valuables and all of the treasuries of the temple and of the king. There's little doubt that this was motivated by pride on Hezekiah's part, and Nebuchadnezzar must have known about the treasure. This may be one of the reasons that he stopped chasing Pharaoh Necho and stopped to attack and besiege Jerusalem. In verse 4, we see some of the attributes that are necessary to serve in the king's court in Babylon. It involves finding boys with certain traits and then educating them in the Chaldean system. If you were to serve the king in Babylon, you had to be a person with no defect. The Hebrew word there for no defect means no physical defect, but it also means no moral defect. So it is an all-encompassing term. They must be good-looking. They must be handsome. These boys must be, the text says, intelligent in all areas of wisdom. Here the word that's used describes insight. It describes a person who is prudent. They must be discerning of knowledge. They must have a high IQ, and they must have a proclivity to understand science and mechanics, which were two things that the Chaldeans excelled in quite well. And the last attribute is they had to be able to stand in the king's palace. This really means that they had to be people of poise. They could not falter under pressure. When Nebuchadnezzar asks his chief of staff to educate the boys, what he's really telling them to do is to brainwash them. They were to learn and to converse in the Chaldean language, a necessary step to the ultimate goal of making them think like Chaldeans. If you want someone to think like a Chaldean, he needs to speak the Chaldean language. I think there would be more than one language in play here. The spoken language of the Chaldeans was a West Semitic language similar to Aramaic. By the time of Daniel, a Mesopotamian dialect of Aramaic had become the common language of the region, and we see similar dialect in portions of the Old Testament. The book of Daniel, chapter 2, verse 4 through 7, 28 is written in this dialect of Aramaic. Ezra 4, 8 through 6, 18 and 7, 12 through 26 are written in Aramaic. There's an Aramaic term in Jeremiah 10, 11 and another in Genesis 31, 47. But the official documents of the Chaldean Empire and the Babylonian Empire as well would have been written in Akkadian. So I suspect that these boys were taught both the current dialect of Aramaic as well as the Akkadian language. Language and names are related. By changing the names of these boys, the chief of staff attempted to demonstrate his power over their choices. If I have the power to change your name and to tell you what by the name by which you'll be called, I can pretty well do anything with you that I want to. It's an exercise of power by a superior over an inferior. It also was an attempt to wipe out their former selves, their loyalties, and to change their identities. As you probably know, Hebrew names all have specific meanings, and in many cases they have something to say about the character of the person who has that name. So these new names given to the boys link them to the king, but they also were an attempt to wipe out the former Hebrew identities of these young men. The word Daniel means God will judge. It's a common Hebrew name, but it's particularly significant in this context. God indeed will judge, as we'll see. He'll judge in terms of how he deals with the individual circumstances of these boys. And more significantly, he will judge in how he deals with the empire that exiled them. Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar, which probably means Bel's prince. Bel is an actual title. It's not a name. It is sort of the equivalent of the Hebrew word Adonai, Lord, or Adon. It was the title Lord. The Lord in the Babylonian pantheon was Marduk. So Belteshazzar, which probably means something like Bel's prince, was a reference to Marduk, and it was essentially saying this is a prince or a servant to Marduk. Hananiah, one of his friends, means Yahweh is gracious. It may seem to be an odd name, Yahweh is gracious, under the circumstances of exile, but the fact is God's nature hasn't changed. He's no less at work in the life of Hananiah in Babylon than he is in the history that'll unfold there over the next 70 years. Hananiah's name was changed to Shadrach. I can do one of two things at this point. I can either tell you the truth, which is no one really knows what Shadrach means, or I can give you four or five different completely opposite meanings for it that are probably all wrong. So we'll leave it at, we don't know what it means. Mishael means who is what God is. From his name, I would guess that this young man's father was a man who spent much of his life contemplating the mysteries of God. And when he named his son, whom God had given him, the majesty of God was at the forefront of his mind. No one is like God. He's one of a kind. Mishael's name was changed to Meshach, meaning also unknown. Azariah means Yahweh is my help. This is a name that could provide great comfort in times of trouble. Azariah, though, was referred to by the new Chaldean name Abednego, which means the servant of Nabu, one of the Babylonian gods, happens to be the Babylonian god of education. He's second in the Babylonian pantheon. So there's a sense in which, by naming Azariah Abednego, the Chaldeans are really letting the intent of what they are trying to do here sneak out a little bit. They're going to educate the Hebrew faith out of these boys. That's their intent. But it didn't work. I wish I could say the same thing about our educational system today, because unfortunately, it is working today. And we've lost the majority of a generation to American colleges and universities. I used to say, intending to be humorous, that one thing I learned as an adult was that almost everything I learned in college turned out to be wrong. I still say it, but I say it with a heavy heart. So the purpose of their education is indoctrination in the Chaldean culture. The presumption here is that this will turn them away from their native Hebrew culture and the faith which it embodied. There are few things that are more indicative of culture than diet. Today we regularly speak of Italian food, Cajun food, Chinese food, Mexican food. We classify these cultures by the kind of food they cook. It's so ingrained in our culture, if I say to Linda, how about Thai tonight? She knows I don't mean let's go to the mall and buy a Thai. She knows I'm talking about Thai food. And she's probably going to say, well, do you want to go to Mango Thai or Best Thai? And then we'll pick. She knows what I'm saying. Immigrants tend to hold on to cooking traditions and recipes that reflect their native heritage. It was no less true in the ancient world, but if you were a Jew, living under the Mosaic law, there was more to consider than the preferences of your palate. Diet and identity were more firmly interlinked for Jews than any other ethnic group. Italians like Italian food because that's what their mothers cooked when they lived at home. But the substitution of the king's food for the food prescribed in the Mosaic law was a far different matter. Access to God through worship for the Jews was directly linked to ceremonial cleanness as prescribed in the law of Moses. The classic example that we all know is that Jews don't eat pork. But it goes well beyond that. Even meats that were considered clean had to be prepared in a certain way. For example, meat and dairy products couldn't come into contact with one another. So if you think about this in terms of the Mosaic law, you begin to see the problems that Daniel and his friends had with the king's food. You may recall Peter's dilemma recorded in Acts 10 regarding unclean food. But there was a bigger issue. The food of the palace probably had been offered sacrificially to the gods of Babylon, and particularly the wine for drink offerings and the meat, which would have been burned on Babylonian altars. The real issue here is the interplay of faith and culture. H.R. Niebuhr, that would be Richard, not Reinhold, wrote on this question, and he identified five views of the relationship of Christ and culture, which just so happens to be the name of a book that he wrote in 1951. At the two extremes in his book are views that either totally oppose or totally assimilate the two. Of course, the other three then fall somewhere in the middle. It's true that some things are cultural, but other things aren't. Whether you wear a tie to church is cultural. How you define marriage is not. For Daniel, the dietary laws of the Mosaic covenant were not cultural issues, but were fundamental to their faith. Jesus was criticized at times for some of his associations by the professional religious people. But when we try to understand this tension between faith and culture, it's important to remember that when Jesus associated with sinners, it was not to become more like them, but it was for the express purpose of making them like him. It's true that Jesus said to the sinful woman, "Where are they, thine accusers?" But he also said, "Go and sin no more." In our day, I see the issue like this. And I know I've said this before in this class. Either the Bible will inform how we relate to the culture, or the culture will inform how we relate to the Bible. It's one or the other. And this is Daniel's dilemma. We see something here about the character of a 14-year-old boy who was mature beyond his years. Because he takes the initiative from the chief of staff of the king of Babylon, and he draws the line between faith and culture along the issue of diet. Look at verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice of food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. The key phrase there is Daniel set upon his heart. It's translated, Daniel made up his mind in the NASB, and Daniel purposed in his heart in the King James. The point is, Daniel made a decision, and it was not an arbitrary decision. It was a decision based on what he knew to be right, and he knew what was right because it was right, not because it seemed to be right to him. It was a decision based on what he had been taught by his parents from the Hebrew scriptures. He knew about the dietary laws of the Mosaic law, and he must have known texts like Deuteronomy 32, 36 through 39, which discussed that. He must have known the commandments. He must have known that when the Chaldeans and the Babylonians forced him or tried to force him to worship false gods, that it was contrary to the revealed word of God in Exodus. So Daniel's decision has to do with food, but it has to do with more than food. It had to do with his commitment to the entire Mosaic law. Verse 9. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should I see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. Ashpenaz was the chief of the officials. He had grown fond, apparently, of Daniel. He would be willing to accommodate him except for one thing. In those days, kings cut off the heads of the staff who disobeyed an order. And the king had ordered a certain diet for these boys. Now, if you recall back at the beginning of this section, one of the attributes that these boys have to have is they have to be healthy. Malnutrition is not a good thing in this set of circumstances. So what Daniel does is he turns to an overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over him. He turns to a person one level below Ashpenaz. And apparently this is a different person who reported up. So for 10 days, he says, give us vegetables and water, keep you the wine, and then draw your own conclusions about our health. Then compare us to the other boys who are eating what the king ordered, and make your own decision. So he agreed to this, and it was probably, he thought, well, 10 days, that's not long enough that I'm going to lose my head. We'll see what happens here. And he does then, in fact, conduct this test. Verse 15. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food, the wine that they were to drink, and he gave them vegetables. Tests usually elicit questions, and there are two fundamental questions that come to mind at this point in the story. One is, why obey God when he's just allowed Jerusalem to fall to the Chaldeans? Why not just give up on God? And the second one would be, what happens to believers who find themselves living in the midst of a pagan culture? Well, there's already been a hint to the answer for the first question. It was the Lord who gave Jerusalem and her king into the hand of the Chaldean general. Therefore, Yahweh is still in control. God is at work through the discipline that he's bringing on the nation by means of this remnant which he intends to save out of exiled Israel. As for the second question, God providentially granted favor to Daniel in the eyes of these overseers. Daniel gives us insight as an example of how believers are to live in a pagan society. The more Daniel learns about the Babylonian culture, the more committed he becomes to Yahweh and his law. The more I observe and think about our culture, the more I'm convinced of the truth of Scripture. Of course, the danger with Daniel and with anyone is that the opposite would be concluded. So it becomes clear early in this story that God intends to give good favor and success to Daniel. And we see that happening during this 10-day test that's just been concluded. I think I'm going to stop at this point, because if I get into the next section, we're going to run really late. And I think we'll stop at verse 15 and pick this up next week.